what I thought we would talk about today is Kevin Gilbert.
Mm.
Now, Kevin, people who remember, a very, very active Aboriginal. And there are three anniversaries, as it turns out. It's 80 years this year since he was born on the banks of the river at Condobolin. It's 20 years since he died, so he lived to be 60. And it's 40 years since his probably best-known book, which was called Because a White Man Will Never Do It, was published. And intriguingly, what put this into my mind is that the book is about to be republished.
Oh,
one
fabulous.
Of the major publishers is getting it back into print. It may be in the shops already.
Mm.
So I thought those things, and then one other little bit popped into my mind. I used to collect Australian stamps before they got so ugly I can't bear to look at them. but recently they've just put out five stamps with Aboriginals on.
Yes.
And you know, you can pick whichever ones you like there. But they've got, of course, Neville Bonner, Liberal Party senator, and Charlie Perkins, who was in and out of the Liberal Party, as he was in and out of many of the bits of political life in Australia. But, of course, Kevin Gilbert's chances of getting on a postage stamp are not all that great.
No. Humphrey, last Thursday night when we had our conversation with Julian Assange, Uncle Larry Walsh, who's a Tungurung elder and has been my mentor for more years than I care to remember, and I'm deeply grateful for that, but like Kevin, shared that institutionalised early life, and yet for someone who missed out on what we'd call a decent Western education, remains, in my view, one of the most naturally intelligent and wonderful conversationalists about any subject in the world. And that's what's true about Kevin. People might remember Kevin Gilbert for a variety of reasons. Political activists would know him from his tent embassy days. People who are of an artistic bent would know him from his writings. And again, for someone who had, as we were about to point out, a very, very disturbed upbringing, an amazing achievement. So do you want to just briefly describe how his early days took place?
His parents, he's the youngest of eight kids, I think. He's left without either parent from the age of seven. He is then goes into orphanage, which he runs away from, a very, very common experience of escape, and goes back and lives on the camps with his own people, who were the Wiradjuri and the Kamilaroi peoples on his mum's side. And out of that experience, he writes a play in 1968, which is performed, the first Western-style drama, you know, script to be performed in Australia, written by an Aboriginal, The Cherry Pickers. And, we're leaving out a very important element, which I do want to come and stress. But that play reminds us of something, that these, you know, these Aboriginal groups who camped and moved around, there was regular work for them in the 50s, 60s and into the 70s. And they were cherry pickers. And so this play, which is about being Aboriginal and the, you know, the kind of sitting around the camps at night and talking and all of that social and cultural life, but it's also about working life. So it's very much that experience of the working class Aboriginal in Australia. But that play, which he then, you know, updated a bit in 1988, this is one of the things, along with not just you mention about the writing that he did, but he was also a very considerable visual artist. And he learned to do these things when he was in maximum security for 14, almost 15 years. Now, he'd gone into jail for killing his first wife. And, you know, there's no way of getting around that. You know, there's no word you can put on it. I mean, you can say, I think quite reasonably, if he'd been a white lawyer in Sydney who'd done the same thing, he would have got manslaughter 7 years out after three or four. The discrimination there is because he's a black man, he gets a murder, he gets a life sentence, and he only gets out after almost 15 years because... In a strange kind of way, this, what was the predecessor of the Australia Council, has started a program of putting artists into the prison system to get people writing, get them making works of art. And he begins writing poetry in the play, and he writes and he produces really striking lino cuts. And he's doing it with the scraps of lino around the prison system, old spoons, broken razor blades, anything he can lay his hands on. And it's that which comes to people's attention. He has an exhibition which the Council for the Arts, as it was called, sends around Australia. And that helps to get him out. But in thinking about this over the last few days and thinking of all the achievements that he produced in the course of the life after he got out of jail, the most extraordinary thing in some ways is that he did not become a hardened professional criminal. Because that's what the New South Wales prison system was designed to do.
It was a great school, in fact, Humphrey.
It was the postgraduate training school.
That's right.
As I said in the notes to you, you either went to jail to become a professional crim, or you joined the police force.
Yes.
and it made little difference.
Made a bit of difference. You know, but,
the pay was better in the police force.
You sort of did better in the police force out of it.
Well, until they had those mini cameras that they put down by the brakes in that wonderful New South Wales documentary on Roger Rogerson. Was it Roger? Who was receiving the casheroo up beside the gear stick?
But he was in Bathurst, in Maitland, and in Grafton.
And when you mention those three names, you would send a shiver down the spine of anybody who's ever done time in any prison in Australia, because they were notorious. Well, even in the best days of Boggo Road and other places, the Grafton and these jails you've just mentioned were terrifying places to be.
Yeah. Even Pentridge.
Some of the toughest jails in the Western world. Worse than almost anywhere else in Australia. I mean, it's also occurred to me to think about this, as you were saying about, you know, your Aboriginal friend. He wouldn't, of course, been the only Aboriginal in jail. And they may well have, in fact, had people in there who were helping him.
Yep.
Sort of guiding him away from this, you know, broken, violent life that he'd had, that had led to the domestic, that had led to the 14-year sentence that he got. So we shouldn't remember, you know, we should think about that he may have been learning things in there about, you know, about himself as an Aboriginal from those other people there. But of all the things that could happen to anyone in their life, to come out of 15 years of that, of being bashed, these were just the most brutal, violent places and designed to be. To come out of that with this political agenda and this real passion and capacity for producing poetry, plays, visual arts, all of these things. I mean, that survival, not becoming the professional crim, but becoming the full-time activist and artistic creator. I mean, that, of all the things, and God knows we've got plenty to talk about, the things he does once he gets out, immediately. I think there's no delay.
Prolific is one of the words that springs to mind, Humphrey.
Any one of them.
Exactly.
Would be enough to get you a postage stamp.
Can I say something here, Humphrey?
Yeah, of course.
It never ceases to amaze me how Aboriginal people and any non-English-speaking person is judged in terms of intellect and what they produce. It's always judged in terms of white people's view, and whether it is a language or any other activity, cultural activity, is always on white people's terms. Even the conversation we're having today, we are talking in terms of what is seen as cultural, what is seen as valuable to the community from a white person's or white, the dominant culture's point of view. And that saddens me. And Kevin Gilbert is a prime example of the community that has survived over the last over 200 years. He is just one example. There are hundreds of them, but he's outstanding in relation to how white society judges his activities.
Later on, we'll come back to the question of Aboriginal art, example, as one of the examples of both survival and success, again, measured from a Western art point of view.
Yeah, that's
But Humphrey,
it's amazing. Keep going.
Let's have a quick look at some of those amazing things that actually came from both the pen and the political activity of Kevin in that early period after he was paroled.
Well, he gets out in 1971.
Yep.
Which is, in Aboriginal terms, a very active time. Black power has come in the late 1960s.
Yes.
And it is significant, I think, to explain what that was in practical terms and how important the change was. But we've got to go back and acknowledge why you didn't have black power in all parts of Australia prior to that. Now, I was in Queensland, and you were under the Act in Queensland. I was great mates with Uluru, she wasn't under the Act, but the Aborigines I met through the Aboriginal Advancement League up there and things, many of them, the Queenslanders, if they stuck their head up, they could be sent to Palm Island.
Mm. Mm.
And, it was a concentration camp system, so that many of the things that you would think people could do for themselves couldn't be done by Aboriginal people. So that white activists, trade unionists particularly, but a whole range of other people, in which the Communist Party and its supporters played a very important role, had to do these things for Aboriginal people.
Yep.
Now, that begins to change all through the 1960s until... 67, 68, and it's more so in New South Wales and Victoria and South Australia and other places. But it partly happens because the other thing that the Queensland Aborigines could do would be to escape to Redfern.
Mm. Yes.
So a lot of Queensland activists end up down there. Yeah.
I've just recently read through the Act, actually, and I just want to say something about... Uluru, as an Aboriginal person, even had she been exempt from the Act, in most ways she still would have been under the Act because the law reads that an exemption any conditions that the White Protector would like to impose on the Aboriginal person, including continued ownership of their property. So, and all their money. So even if, Uluru hadn't been under the Act, in many ways she would have still been under the Act. And that's, I don't know.
She said to me one day, things developed. She went on an activity into the United Kingdom. And when she came back, she said, I'd never felt free before. Mm-hmm. I could walk down the streets of London and no one looked at me.
Mm-hmm.
I just felt, this was complete. I mean, she was fearless. Just extraordinary. The things that that she was doing in those years and keeping endlessly putting herself out there. By reading the Act, the United Nations Association in Queensland in the late 50s put out a publication in which they documented. My memory is a bit hazy on this, but up to about 100 different ways in which the Act violated the United Nations Charter.
Hmm.
They just went through it, section by section by section. It helped to activate people like me. I think I was 16 when I read that. And I was, the way you are when you're a teenager, outraged, and began to, get active and to do things around it. And I think, so that those changes were there. But for people there in Queensland, but in other parts of Australia as well, it wasn't
indeed.
As if, you were sort of completely free anywhere.
No.
But remember that one of the reasons why the Gordon Bryants of the world were so active on behalf of Aborigines was that Aborigines... in a legal situation where in many parts of Australia it was really perilous for them to do anything. But that changes through the 60s until Bruce McGuinness and those people,
sure.
And you get a black power movement.
And we can see the other side of that in the form of Albert Namatjira, Humphrey, who was in a similar position to some exempt blackfellas, but whose confusions and whose obligations to community and to family meant that he continued to deteriorate rather than to grow as a result of his exemption and his ability to buy booze and all that sort of stuff as a token white fella.
Well, to get the exemption, you actually had to distance yourself from your friends and relatives in the Aboriginal community,
yep.
which But she's just horrid.
And while we're on that, then in the next couple of weeks, Ms. Corey has produced a lovely, lovely piece, which we'll put to air on the program, yep. regarding slavery in relation to Aboriginal people in Queensland and those wonderful, wonderful groups of nuns and other good do-gooders who said, look, I've got a job for you. We're not going to pay you anything, but you're going to come and wash laundry for the next 16 years of your life. And that's something to look forward to, I'm sure.
Well,
the basic argument of my piece is that the Act was slavery, just completely.
Yeah. I mean, have you had a chance to look at Ken Dallas's article on slavery in Australia?
No, I haven't.
Ken was a Tasmanian Marxist, taught economic history down there.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, this is a bit of a segue away from this, but it is on...
Sure, we'll bring you back. We've got your notes.
So anyway, Kevin gets out of jail, 1971, into this totally new Aboriginal... The world, between 57 when he goes in and 71 when he gets out, the Aboriginal world has changed, and a lot of it has changed because of Aboriginal actions themselves.
Mm.
So he comes out into this world. The Cherry Pickers is performed straight away. His first book of poetry, End of Dream Time, is also published. He begins to set up an Aboriginal art gallery. He begins to edit a publication for literary art called El Chiringa. All of those things. And he joins up with the Proofleet community in New South Wales, where he becomes a community development officer, almost straight away up there as well.
And the most significant event on the Australian landscape was that thing called the Tent Embassy.
It was.
Yes, of course.
Early 72. Yeah. Australia Day, as it was then universally known.
Yes.
There was no phrase Invasion Day in 1972. That's one of the things that comes out of those activities. And the Tent Embassy is established there in late January. It's pulled down three times during the month of July and re-erected twice. A couple of huge battles one small battle with the ACT police, one huge battle with the New South Wales coppers who they sent in, and then a huge demonstration when thousands of people turned up to support the embassy one Sunday afternoon to put it back again. But, of course, you know, as soon as the thousands went back after the weekend, down it came again. But that was this great moment. And I can tell you a little story that Bobby Sykes told me out of that. Billy McMahon, who was pretending to be Prime Minister
That's
at
right.
the time, is all you can say. Donald Horne said the McMahon government was the happiest time in Australian European history because we really didn't have a government.
Yeah.
You know, it was just this wonderful, wonderful society with sort of, you know, that we're all full of hope that something would change after the election.
Mm.
And in the meantime, there wasn't a government. So poor old Billy, you know, would swing from one extreme to the other. And they convinced him that he should send the police in and be strong and pull the embassy down and show what a strong leader he was.
Yes.
As somebody today might say, show that you're a man.
Yes.
Yeah. So Billy girds his lines up and he does this. The moment it happens, he panics. Oh, no, we've gone too far. We've got to do something else. So he calls the Aboriginal leaders in to Parliament House. In those days, Parliament was in the old Parliament just opposite the Tent Embassy. He calls them in and he has this bright idea. He'll take them into the Cabinet Room. And so they come into the Cabinet Room and they're all sitting around the table and Billy begins by saying to them how privileged they are to sit at the Cabinet table. Guess what? They get up and sit on the floor.
Well done.
You know, poor old Billy. But there's an indication.
It would have added something to the confusion that was his normal state of existence, Humphrey.
Of that immediate, you know, the spontaneous recognition of what they had to do and what they were arguing for.
Yep, yep.
And, you know, Kevin Gilbert's, you know, very, very much part of that kind of activity. Next year, at all this time, of course, he'd begin to write this, he produces Because a White Man Will Never Do It.
Mm. Yes.
Now, we'll get to that and the issues about that,
yep.
But I think we should just run through the rest of the things
sure.
that...
the achievements.
Yeah, it's amazing.
It is quite extraordinary. I mean, any person would be both proud and considered a significant achiever to have done what he's about to do.
Yeah, well, to do any one of them.
Well, that's right.
Absolutely.
Put you down there, I reckon. Yeah. In 77, he publishes Living Black. Now, Penguin published it.
Mm.
John Hooker, who was a wonderful old New Zealand anarchist, who was the publisher at Penguin, said to me towards the end of his life, he said, you know, all the books I've been associated with in a career in publishing, the two that I'm proudest of were Anne Summers' Damned Whores and God's Police and Kevin Gilbert's Living Black.
Yep.
Because they both changed a whole way of thinking about the Australian experience. And Living Black, I fear, has kind of dropped off the radar.
It has. I mean, just before you came on, we played the song from One Night the Moon by Paul Kelly and Kev Carmody, which absolutely beautifully outlines the distinctions that we draw in relation to the land. And the white fella, of course, Paul Kelly, says, "This land is mine." Kev Carmody's response, of course, which is the absolutely appropriate thing, "I am this land. This land is me."
Yeah.
And it's such a significant difference in
huge.
Both consciousness of place and role that continues to summarise the difference in attitude between white and black fellows in this country.
Yeah. Well, you're more likely to get a kind of collective, you know, this land is ours, you know, rather than it's just mine.
That's right.
You know, that's one of the other layers in this. You know, this is a collectivity.
Mm.
Well, damn, you know, Living Black wins the National Book Council Award. A couple of years later, he's leading a protest in Canberra for Aboriginal sovereignty. Now, we take that kind of phrasing for granted today.
Today.
But it wasn't for granted in the late 1970s. These were things we had to learn. You know, there were things Aboriginals had to learn and teach each other as well.
Yep.
You know, I mean, you know, that's what politics are like. They had to get out of there. Now, one of the things you have to remember about Kevin Gilbert, he was not the easiest person in the world to be around.
Right.
You know, and for good reason. But, you know, and he would take on his own people as much as anybody else.
Yep.
And in 1980, he created an enormous stir by publishing a poem in the Bulletin asking, if I can put this very politely, asking Yvonne Corley-Goolagong why she wasn't sticking her hand up to do something for her own people.
Yes.
You can imagine the kind of response that got inside the Aboriginal community as well.
And yet the lingering evidence is that at long last, probably about 30 years later, she's actually got some things that are at least a bit more than token gestures towards paying her debts back to community.
Yeah, yeah. But, you know, so, I mean, he keeps the fight going in every direction. He's in 88, in 1988, the bicentennial year with the enormous march through the Sydney streets, the overturning and the upsetting of the whole plans as to how to celebrate 200 years of Australia are really derailed by all that Aboriginal activism. But he there comes up as one of the activists, and I've got to be very careful again, which is why I said the thing about our rather than just mine, because a bit of an inclination to say in talking about any one person that, you know, he started the embassy, he started the treaty committee. They were all collective activities.
They were.
Can I say, Humphrey, because I work at the Victorian Aboriginal Health Service, I actually witnessed the spirit displayed among the people there. Like a couple of days ago, I won't mention any names here, but one of the more well-known footy stars came in, and there was no star treatment for this guy. Yvonne Goolagong has been there too. It's a bit of excitement, but they see it in terms of, okay, what have we done for community? That's where they come from, all of them. And the question comes over and over and over again. You can be the most popular person in the world, but you walk in there, you're equal to the rest of the people there as part of the community. There's no, like, you know, a sore thumb sticking out because you happen to be popular in the white community. So that spirit, that notion filters through the community, and I find that really impressive.
We should push on if we're going to talk about the actual content of it. I mean, one of the things he did in 88, and we'll go on, I think, after this, you know, just wind up the life quickly, He was offered a Human Rights and Equal Opportunities Award, and he refused it. You know, he said, yes, I'd be happy to have it when we have Human Rights and Equal Opportunities, but I'm not going to take it until then. He dies in 93. He helps to re-establish the embassy on the 20th anniversary in 1992. So he's around. He's a survivor. Surviving family, Ali, is still active around the embassy there now. I wonder whether this might be, before we go into talking about the implications of the title of the book, an opportunity for one of you to read the poem.
I'd like to do that.
Good. Oh, great.
This is a poem, Mary. Don't be too hard on the males, Mary, when you cry out that they are not men, and too many children are dying, where in God's name will it end? Why don't the men speak and stop it, and why don't they speak out or die, as men with some courage to face it, without the wine courage they buy? Remember, when you sit in the ashes, as tears fall for your kids lying dead, that you're also part of the problem. Guilt equally falls on your head. Your trust in the white man is legion. Your trust in the flag you salute. Stars with the ensign of England, the symbol of vandals and brute. You cling to the White Woman's Weekly and yearn for the world of TV, while women of much stronger fibre make Molotov cocktails for tea.
Well, give you some idea
indeed.
Of the kind of attitudes that he was stirring up in his own community.
Indeed.
Well, rightly so.
It's not something that you would want to be sitting in the front row as he's reading it for the first time, Humphrey.
No.
I remember wandering into a comedy festival event with Uncle Rod Quantock in the main seat, wearing a hat, and he started to pick on blokes wearing hats.
Yeah.
And I was sliding under the seats as rapidly as possible because I didn't want to sit in the front row and gaze, cop the penetrating eye of Rod Quantock. But Kevin Gill, that is an amazing piece of work, Humphrey.
But it's also pulling out people who are being bought off by the white people. That's what is behind all this.
And often bought off without any money.
That's right.
Well,
sometimes, yeah.
Well, I mean, what I thought he might do is to look at some of these, you know, just unpick the words in the title of the book, because a white man will never do it.
Yep.
Yes.
The first thing, when I was looking at it, it occurred to me, though, is if we look at it now, 40 years later, what is the it in this title?
Yep.
Because you might have said 40 years ago that, you know, a white man won't write a book like this. Because now, you know, I mean, you couldn't jump over the books that have been written about all
exactly.
these kinds of issues.
And some of them very decent, Humphreys.
Oh,
I mean,
wonderful. And he'd be more than happy with all of that.
Indeed.
But, again, and a lot of them written by Aboriginal and Islander people as well.
Yep.
So it's not, I think, you know, the kind of story isn't out there for you if you want to know it. So is it more, I think, about a white man will never do it in the sense of the actor? But we still need to think, what is the it
yes.
above all the other things? Because
it's quite particular, isn't it, in one sense, and yet it's also got a universal element to
that's
it,
right.
I suspect.
But, I mean, in terms of political activity, I mean, it's not our job to do this, but I think people should think, you know, we should all think about this. And, you know, the Aborigines think about it, no doubt, all the time, as to what is the it. That they should do. I heard Fiona Stanley being interviewed a couple of weeks ago about the work she does with young and aspiring Aboriginal
medicos.
And they were applying for a massive research grant, you know, like millions of dollars, one of the really big ones.
Yep.
And she said to them, look, you know, you really got to do it. You got to fill out the forms in this sort of way and, you know, get the story across. And they said, no, we don't. They said, what we're going to do is to put in an application to say we don't know what we want to research because we haven't spoken to the people.
Yep.
Yes.
And she said,
that'll never work.
You know, you don't get money that way. And she said, that's what we're going to do. And she said, I was wrong and they were right.
Yes. That was an extraordinary interview, Humphrey. It was an extraordinary interview with an extraordinary woman.
Yes, she is.
And her achievements are something that maybe at some stage or other we really ought to dwell on because there are too few of them.
You should bring her up and talk to her.
Yeah, no, exactly. Yeah.
You know, she used to go to Black Power meetings in the 60s.
Yes.
As I said to you, I think, once before on the program, she was being interviewed when she stood down as head of the Institute, and she said in the course of the interview, as if it was the most natural thing in the world. Well, of course, I'm a socialist.
Mm. Yes.
The interviewer, fell off the chair.
Yeah.
So we might ask ourselves, could we phrase it differently now? Because a white woman would never do it.
Mm.
And then you'd have to say, well, in terms of
she
doing
tried.
Things, you know...